Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Emily Manning, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a litigation update on Gerber v. Ohio Northern University. We're joined today by Benjamin M. Flowers, partner at Ashbrook Byrne Kresge, and our moderator today is Dan Morinoff, executive director at the American Civil Rights Project and an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federal Society. With that, thank you for tuning in today. And Dan, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Emily. Appreciate it. So I guess I should briefly introduce Ben, because he's really the one who's going to be talking. Although, let me also just say, you know, we're glad you're here. We hope you find this interesting. We do. Ben is a graduate of the Ohio State University and University of Chicago Law School, former clerk to Ninth Circuit Judge Ikuda and Justice Scalia of blessed memory. He was Ohio's 10th Solicitor General, and as Emily mentioned, currently a partner at Ashbrook Byrne Kresge. So, look, we're here because, Ben, along with America First Legal, you have a case that we thought our audience should know more about. Scott Gerber versus Ohio Northern University and Ohio Northern University Board of Trustees. There is a lot going on in this case. Maybe we should start here. Can you tell me a little bit about Professor Gerber's background? Who are we talking about?
Yeah, well, let me first say I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me. As you mentioned, you know, I'm the one speaking today, but I am far from the only attorney on this case. So my partner, Julie Byrne, is intimately involved. And then, as you mentioned, America First Legal, this is, you know, really their case that we're partnering with them on. And, you know, when I left the SG shop, I wanted to go somewhere where I could build a private practice, but also keep doing a lot of the work, the public cause sort of work that I did as SG. And getting to work with America First Legal on those sorts of cases like this one has really been a blessing. So I did want to make sure that I emphasized, you know, how much involvement they have with this and how great they've been. Remind me the question exactly was,
no problem.
A little bit about Dr. Gerber.
I thought of a good place to start might be just tell us about Scott Gerber. Who is Professor Gerber? What's his story?
Sure. Dr. Gerber is a very accomplished scholar. He is, I think he would call himself a libertarian, definitely on the right side of the spectrum, particularly among American law schools, but an incredibly accomplished and really impressive legal scholar. He does write constitutional theory, sort of invented the or coined the phrase liberal originalism, which I think you might associate with Justice Thomas's view that the Declaration of Independence and sort of the founding principles can inform the proper interpretation of the Constitution. So he's written at length about that and other issues, actually written about anti-discrimination issues, which is kind of funny given the context of this case, which we'll get to.
Sure.
But he's also a historian. You know, in coming to, in taking on this case, I've had a chance to look at some of his work and has done a lot of really impressive research into judicial independence and how it came to be early in the American states and colonies. You know, really one of the maybe all too rare professors nowadays who teach at a law school and actually are interested in law and legal history. And as you'll hear, he is currently out of a job. So if you know of a law school that's looking for an accomplished scholar, you should email me and I can let him know. And maybe we can get that situation fixed.
And you mentioned in particular that I mean, we know he was a professor and he was also teaching law. How are there any good metrics we have for Professor Gerber as a teacher?
He won teaching awards. I know that. You know, this is all personal experience, so it's not something I can like point you to and give you a particular page in the record, I guess, where there's evidence of this, but, you know, very well respected by students. In the aftermath of this case, you had students defending him. I know he worked with them to help them get published, and some have recently. So, you know, it's a guy, I've come to know him, and he's just very dedicated to the teaching of law and the preparation of students to go become good lawyers and maybe even good scholars. So that's my two cents on that.
Sure. And I know a moment ago you were joking about the record, whether you could point at it. Just to get this entirely clear at the front end and to explain what I think might be some choice of tense issues as we're discussing the case. What stage of litigation is the case currently in?
So we just actually just today, the other side filed their reply in support of a motion to dismiss or partial motion to dismiss. So pretty early on in the case, we filed a second amended complaint, when we became involved with America First in, the complaint was filed in January. So, you know, we're in discovery, we're doing, the motions to dismiss, trials currently scheduled for September with dispositive motions due at the end of May. So those who are interested and might think they want to do an amicus brief or something, those deadlines are worth keeping in mind. And you mentioned sort of choice, my choices of tense and things. I should emphasize, since we're still at the pleading stage, you know, I don't want to say anything that'll jeopardize the case or to overclaim. So I'll try to just stick to the allegations, and you know what we're alleging happened. But I'm confident that,
that there's something
job for Scott. Yeah.
No, please. Okay. So, and also because having read through that pleading, I certainly haven't yet read an answer. Can you tell us the procedural backstory here? Because that's also kind of complicated. Like what had happened before the filing of the incident litigation?
Yeah. So, if you read our complaint, you'll see what we allege is that he was on April 14th, brought to the dean's office by security with ADA police presence at the law school after he finished teaching a class, brought to the dean's office where the dean informed him that he was being effectively given the choice to either resign or face removal proceedings. He did not resign. They initiated these proceedings, but neither the dean nor the school was telling Dr. Gerber precisely what he was accused of having done. There were sort of vague allegations of lack of collegiality, but nothing specific. And it's, as the lawyers on this call know, it's hard to defend yourself against accusations you don't, when you don't know what the accusations are. So nonetheless, they went forward with the hearing, or tried to, and sent him effectively an email with the statement of grounds for dismissal. That statement of grounds for dismissal, which I think was in June, still did not give specifics about what he was accused of having done. And he was given mere days to prepare witnesses, again, witnesses to rebut allegations that he wasn't, that didn't put him on notice of what he was being accused of, and to get ready for a hearing. So at that point, Dr. Gerber, who was then represented by different counsel, brought a lawsuit, and it's the current suit. But filed suit in the Hardin County Court of Common Pleas in Ohio and sought a TRO and eventually a preliminary injunction. The court granted a TRO to forestall the hearing and eventually ordered that Ohio Northern provide him with a bill of particulars that would state what he was accused of having done and the documents on which they were relying and things like that so he could defend himself. So with that in hand, the court did allow the TRO to expire and let a disciplinary hearing before a 5-member faculty panel go forward last August. Despite giving the bill of particulars, we allege that they deviated from that bill of particulars and actually brought up other allegations that he wasn't put on notice of, and that formed those allegations formed a basis for his removal. And we can come to that later. But the other thing I should note is while this was happening, you know, the case had gotten some press, and Ohio Northern issued a effectively a press release in June that we say can only be fairly read to accuse Dr. Gerber of being a threat to the safety of the campus community. Now, that wasn't alleged as a basis for his removal. He's not a safety threat, never has been. And in fact, in their motion to dismiss, they denied that they even that the thing we point to actually calls him a safety threat. But that gave rise to what we regard as defamation. We've alleged a defamation claim based on that, and the sort of a false light claim based on the, you know, being hauled out of class by security in the presence of students. So, you know, he got to the hearing, he had the hearing, they eventually recommended, found him guilty as charged and recommended his dismissal in September. And the Board of Trustees ultimately accepted that and in October formally terminated his employment. And as I said, we got involved months later in December with America First and filed a second amended complaint.
Okay, let me, I just want to make sure that people caught a couple of details that were, I think, interspersed there.
Sure, yeah.
You said that he was hauled down to the dean's office by armed guards or police or whoever it was. And I think later on you mentioned that he was actually pulled out of class. Is that right?
Well, there's a dispute about whether it was during the class or after class ended, but in any event, there were security guards came to retrieve him from the classroom area and bring him to Dean Rose, or at least that's what we're alleging. And okay. ADA police were on hand while that was happening. And Dr. Gerber has spoken out about how it was, you know, terrifying because you have police there with guns and everything else bringing you to the dean's office. And I think anyone put in that situation would be understandably frightened, particularly when you don't, upon reaching the dean's office, learn what you're accused of having done.
Sure. And let me go back for one additional detail. Was there any history from before that incident that might shed light on why he was being treated in this way?
At that point, no. I think there were suspicions.
I don't mean what he might have been accused of.
But
did he have a history of interactions with the administration that may be relevant?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. You know, we allege second count is that he was terminated for objecting to illegal hiring practices. So, you know, Dr. Gerber is not just a go along to get along guy. He's someone who is going to speak up for what he believes in. When he sees wrongdoing, when he sees ethical lapses, he is going to raise those. And so he believed, based in part on the answers to an ABA questionnaire that are attached to our complaint, where the university says it considers diversity in making hiring decisions, that the university was unlawfully considering race, sex, and ethnicity in deciding whom to hire, and raised objections to this. And that's in addition to scholarship addressing the legal perils of racial discrimination, plus the fact that he had lodged complaints with government agencies about these practices, and had been outspoken on the issue just in sort of the general press. He'd written op-eds and things of that nature. I think many of the people on this call probably know, they've seen from schools around the country, that is not an orthodox viewpoint, shall we say, in legal academia. I think it's actually quite common in the rest of the world that we shouldn't treat people differently based on immutable traits, but in terms of hiring anyway. But when on campus with the current DEI push that you see all around the country, you know, that is not a popular view. And so, you know, we'll get to the hiring decision later, but we allege quite clearly that not only was he fired for objecting to illegal hiring practices, but actually that the hearing committee, when it issued its report, confirmed that was one of the bases for his termination.
Okay. Are there any other facts that you know, the audience should know as to how this all played out through y'all's entry?
You know, I think you got the gist. I mean, I guess there's sort of several categories of cases. There's the defamation point, which I mentioned earlier, which I'll include false light in that. There's the Ohio Revised Code 4112.02 claim. That's the retaliation claim based on objecting to illegal hiring. There's that point. And then there's sort of just constant breach of contract issues. So we mentioned some of the breaches. They were required by the contract to give them notice of the wrongdoing. They didn't do that. They were forced to. But even once they did, through the bill of particulars, they departed from that as they proceeded to the hearing. In addition to that, the contract gives guarantees a right, at least within reason, to cross-examine witnesses. And to confront the witnesses against you, yet the witnesses appeared by video at his hearing, some of them. So just a litany of problems. Oh, that's in addition to conflicts of interest. So we allege, for example, that the committee, the five-member committee, was advised by an attorney who reported to the president herself. The problem with that is that the president is actually the prosecutor in these cases. So it would be like having a criminal court in which the judge is advised an ex parte basis by a lawyer for the prosecutor's office, even if it's not the lawyer representing the prosecutor.
Are there any other claims here?
We went through the breach of contract, of course, right. The retaliation, wrongful termination claim, defamation, false light, intentional infliction of emotional distress. And then there was conversion and replevin as well, because upon his leaving, his property was still in the office. And we allege that they unlawfully retained that property by denying his reasonable request to come and get it effectively.
And have they cured that, or is that's still the case?
I won't comment on that just because that's not public, but
okay, fair enough.
One of the allegations, yeah.
Okay, so if that's what's in this litigation as a whole, why is it important? Why should people care?
I think people should care for a variety of reasons. One, if we go back, if you remember what I said at the outset of what he was sort of warned about, there was this collegiality issue.
Yeah.
Now, we don't actually think that was the real basis for the termination, but even assume it was, for the sake of argument, one thing listeners might take from this case is the danger of these collegiality requirements in academia. The squeaky wheel can often be regarded as not being sufficiently collegial. I think I don't have to spell out what the issues are. There are all kinds of issues that on campuses around the country, if you take certain positions, you will be regarded as engaging in abusive conduct almost. There are lines of inquiry that are completely off limits. And it's really hurt not only the schools, but the ability of policymakers to rely on research they're getting from even scientists, because if you know going in that there's only one result that you'll be allowed to publish, then it's hard to know what to do with research on confirming what is already the popular view. And these collegiality clauses can be used to significantly imperil really free discourse on university campuses. Beyond that, there's also, of course, the allegation that he was fired for objecting to illegal hiring. In light of the recent trend, call it, in Supreme Court jurisprudence, there are more opportunities for attorneys and for clients to object to discrimination in hiring, to giving people a leg up or punishing them based on their race or their sex or their ethnicity or whatever else. Whatever you think of Bostock says that it's a Title VII violation to give someone anything that they wouldn't have gotten or any sort of treatment they wouldn't have gotten, but for sex. And the same logic applies to race and everything else. So that sure seems, on any fair reading, in my view, to mean that considering these traits at all in the hiring process is a problem. But if businesses are allowed to threaten retaliation against individuals who engage in that conduct, it will be much, much harder to right those wrongs because people will be afraid to blow the whistle. So that's another important component of that. And then, you know, I think we've seen recently at Harvard and other things that have gone on that the universities are almost coming to regard themselves just sort of a law unto themselves, that they can act in any way they want without having to worry about the consequences. I think some are learning the hard way from plagiarism research and everything else that there are plenty of things the public can do when it's upset. But in any event, I think it is another case where, in our view, the university is flouting the law, and individuals who work for the university are ignoring the law. And it's important to make sure that they not be permitted to get away with that.
Sure. And this may be a little bit repetitive, but like at best, a collegiality standard is an empty standard of, you know, do your peers think you're nice? At best, it obviously could be strategically wielded against people to take that, you know, Midwestern nice requirement and turn it into a sword to destroy people that just disagree on substance. It seems like that's particularly problematic to have as a rule for law professors. Like,
at least
my experience, like, law professors, if they're doing their job, are confrontational. So how on earth can that be the standard for firing a tenured law professor?
And I think that's part of the problem, is it's not, and what you were saying, I'm just sort of restating it, but it's not a, it's not an allegation, lack of collegiality, that's really falsifiable in most cases. Now, there may be extreme cases where everyone can agree, but generally speaking, that's something that whenever someone's unhappy with the way someone else is carrying themselves, they can level that accusation. And when you have this sort of kangaroo court process that allows people to punish their adversaries, it's pretty easy to imagine how that can be used to punish people who take unpopular positions. I know the American Association of University Professors and other groups pretty outspoken against these collegiality requirements. I think I've seen George Leaf maybe at National Review write about this. I don't know how common they are, frankly, but I know this is not unique. So it's something that people should certainly be interested in and concerned about, because allowing universities to point to a kind of vacuous requirement like that is really a threat to academic freedom. And again, academic freedom isn't important just for the professors or just for the universities or just for the students. When legislators make laws, when administrators consider policies, they want to be able to look to research on various subjects. And if entire lines of inquiry are foreclosed, and there's just not, it won't be possible to get reliable research on that. And it harms all of the public, not just those at schools.
And in terms of the systematic danger that we're talking about, I know these are not your case, but you know, just as someone who follows academia loosely, I mean, it seems like there have been a series of academics against whom I'll go ahead and describe them, though I won't put you on the spot there, as vacuous claims to justify suspensions or efforts to revoke tenure, whether you're talking about someone like Amy Wax, basically for saying impolite things about race-based admissions, or whether you're talking about someone like the Harvard economist Roland Fryer, who had simply, as you were more or less discussing, just researched what is the statistical regularity with which forces used against perps by police officers. And when he published findings the university didn't like, they chose to suspend him, investigate him, pursue, I won't call it parallel, but like, and pursue what options they had before eventually just putting him back. It seems like all of that matters, especially when coupled with what at least reads from the complaint to be pretty clear defamation untied to any allegation the school ever actually made in its kangaroo court.
Yeah, I mean, I think you noted the trend. And what's also interesting about the trend you noticed is that it tends to, although right-leaning members of university faculties are a very small percentage of those faculties, they sure seem to make up a disproportionate percentage of these sorts of incidents. That in and of itself, I think, can be indicative and goes to why people really should care about this case. And I should note, I started by talking about America First. I should note that if you're aware of people facing that sort of situation, that's one group to reach out to because they're very active in this space, litigating suits around the country where people are railroaded for objecting to illegal practices. So Gerber's is one case they're involved in, but there are others as well.
Okay, let me pull out another thread here. You mentioned, I think you said there were 8 claims. Am I right? They're all state law claims.
Correct, yep.
Is that important in and of itself?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. I think what people need to remember is that, and I know Judge Sutton's probably been on this very webinar urging the importance of appealing to state law. But in interpreting state law, state courts are, of course, the final word, the state Supreme Court. And that means that you have the ability through state law to bring claims that maybe even the U.S. Supreme Court interpreting federal law or applying state law, I mean, you're not going to get to the U.S. Supreme Court in a diversity case, probably where they're applying state law. But in terms of interpreting their own law, they might not buy. So there's much more opportunity to make, useful doctrine in the state courts. And the virtue of that is you can, the states can really serve as laboratories of not so much democracy, but like, I guess it is actually because they're interpreting laws that pass democratically, but also common lawsuits. They can serve as testing grounds for ideas. And if states, our large states like Ohio and Texas, for example, are adopting certain theories and those, the sky doesn't fall, the economy doesn't crash, everything continues to go as one would hope. That's evidence for the court that you're on to something. And I mean, one good example of a context in which this happened is the Chevron context. So if you listen to the argument in the Loper-Bright case this term, Judge Kavanaugh specifically asked S.G. Prelogger about the fact that many states have abandoned their Chevron equivalents. And I'm happy to say I was involved in the case where Ohio got rid of its equivalent. But in any event, in those states, which are geographically and politically diverse, the world's continued to turn. Nothing bad's happened. The government still is able to function. And that serves as reassurance to the Supreme Court that they can abandon that case without creating all kinds of undesirable consequences. And so the same logic applies in the context of these, any type of claim. And so pursuing things through state law allows you to take advantage of that divided federal system we have.
Sure. And there are many states non-discrimination laws on the books that are at least as generous as federal law, even if people, I think lots of litigators think first and foremost of, the federal toolkit as what's out there, just to take one example, I know that New York has a human rights law, which by its terms expressly is, as passed by the legislature, is intended to be more protective than federal law. Or I think the same is even true of what the New Jersey law against discrimination, or those are some of the most aggressive, but I mean, there are ones in California, there are ones in Massachusetts, there are ones in lots of states. Obviously, buyer beware, go find what those statutes actually say rather than relying on my quick shorthand summary. But
Yeah. And I think, you know, there are other advantages to state court as well. Number one, not everywhere, but oftentimes cases progress faster there than they do in federal court. So you can get relief for your client more quickly. Sometimes you can avoid, by avoiding removal, by being in state court, you have a jury pool that's more truly representative than you might get in some gigantic district that's bringing people in from all over. So there are many reasons that lawyers can legitimately choose to pursue just state law claims. I'm not going to comment on precisely why we made the choice we did in this case. But in general, I think state law is an underutilized tool. So if I can come and preach the gospel on that a little bit, I'm happy to do so.
Well, absolutely. forgive me. With that, you know, I know we've got at least a couple questions from the audience. Let me throw a couple of those at you. Our first, submitted anonymously, asks, did the university force faculty members to take DEI training or classes?
I actually don't know the answer to that. We don't allege that. But I know there was a DEI policy. So it could be, I don't want to speculate.
Sure. And we've got one other so far. If anyone does have additional audience questions, by all means, feel free to submit them. The remaining one that I'm seeing reads, oh, and it's from Sarah Reese. Is there anything in his performance reviews or student feedback that the university claims support its actions?
We're still, I think, trying to determine what exactly they're going to say support the actions. That's part of the problem with the lack of notice. So sure. I want to be careful to overclaim on that. One thing I'm confident saying, though, is that as far as I know right now, they're not pointing to anything based on like interactions with students or anything like that. So in terms of teaching ability, that sort of thing, I don't think anyone questions that.
Sure. And as you mentioned earlier, I mean, he received teaching awards, which right. I assume without knowing were voted on by students. So
teaching awards and awards for a scholarship,
which aren't. So that's both a professional check and a market check.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
we do have an anonymous, not a question as it's both parsed. A few of Professor Gerber's students are here watching who were in the con law class the day he was escorted out. We would love to have you pass on to him how wonderful a professor he is and how greatly we miss him, Rich. Okay.
Well, hello, our friends in Ada, Ohio. I'm down in the Columbus area, but good to have you with us. No, I mean, I can't imagine. I'm sure Dr. Gerber's listening or will listen later, and I know that'll mean a lot. But even for me, that's a very moving thing to say. Glad to hear that.
I think that's what we've got so far. So unless there are any, hold on, there are more. I just hadn't paged down. We had a question, where will the jury pool be drawn from? I don't know Ohio geography. I have no idea where this school even is.
Hardin County is northwest. I guess you could say the northwest part of the central part of the state. So south of Toledo, northwest of Columbus.
Okay. And it's presumably the county pool. So while much of what I heard you say focuses on contract law, are the more broad First Amendment claims, which I guess would also ask, have any been asserted?
Right. So I think there are First Amendment principles implicated, like, the free speech clause. We didn't bring a First Amendment claim because Ohio Northern University, though its name might suggest otherwise, is not a state school. It is a private institution, and private institutions are not directly bound by the free speech clause.
Sure. No, that makes sense. And we've got one last. Is there an internet source for viewing the pleadings, motions, and other filings in this case?
Yeah. So the Hardin County Clerk of Court has a good website, or the Hardin County Common Pleas Court. If you Google that, you'll see there's an electronic docket, and it's really easy to use. And the case number is 2023, so it was filed last year. 1107.
Okay.
So 2023.
That's publicly available. That's not something that like only lawyers can access.
No, it's free. It's available to everyone. And, you know, in Ohio, unlike in the federal system, we don't have to pay to see our public documents that make up our court records. So some counties have, are better or worse at actually getting that stuff online. But Hardin County does a really good job. It's up quickly and very easy to access and figure out.
Well, that's wonderful. Is there anything else you want to close with?
No, I think I'd just say, first of all, thanks for having me. It's been a privilege to be in this case. I know America First feels the same way. Right. You know, if you're interested in helping with an amicus brief or something, certainly reach out to me. I'm happy to talk about how that might work. And like I said, you know, I've come to really admire Dr. Gerber, not only as a scholar, but as a person. And I think you just heard a student's testimony. So if you think you have leads or we can get this guy back in a classroom in front of students who obviously benefited quite a bit from him, please do reach out to me because I'd really like to make that happen.
Sure. And I just want to thank you for coming and telling us about this. I do think that this is an important case that people should follow and know more about. And I hope you'll keep us informed as it continues to develop.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Please. Emily?
On behalf of the Federal Society, thank you all for joining us for this great discussion today. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.